This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good evening. Welcome to the CAPS Forum on Ethics and Public Policy. My name is Greg Jarrett. I represent the Walter H. CAPS Center for the Study of Ethics, Religion, and Public Life. Thank you for showing up. We're really very pleased at the turnout of young people especially and the involvement of the sciences in particular. We're very happy that you're here to participate in the CAPS Forum. Today we're very pleased to have Dr. Marcy Darnowski from the Center of Genetics and Society to come speak to us about some of the issues in gene editing, in designer babies, or consumer-driven eugenics, or Roundup-ready children, or whichever way you like to frame the issue. So tonight we have Dr. Marcy Darnowski, Executive Director of the Center for Genetics and Society. She frequently appears on television and radio and has written extensively on the ethics and politics of human biotechnology. She has many articles published, for example, in the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, the Wall Street Journal, The Nation, The Guardian, Harvard Law and Policy Review, and Nature. Some publications include The Battle to Patent Your Genes, The Meaning of the Myriad Case, Moral Questions of an Altogether Different Kind, The Consequence of Unnatural Selection, 160 Million Missing Girls, Eggs and Ethics in the Stem Cell Debate, Donor-Conceived Children in Search of Their Biological Histories. She was also last year invited to the International Summit on Gene Editing in Washington, D.C. Tonight, she's going to raise some questions about should we genetically modify our children. So please welcome Dr. Marcy Darnowski. Thank you.
Okay, let's see. Does that sound okay to everybody? Sorry, there might be a little feedback there, so I'll stay away from there, except when I have to advance the slides. So I'm very pleased to be here to talk with all of you tonight, and I want to thank the CAPS Center for inviting me here. I think there's a lot of interest in this topic. The question in the title, should we genetically modify our children? As I think many of you know, this is not a hypothetical question anymore. This is on the foreseeable horizon, and so it's something that we all have to grapple with. The current wave of controversy about modifying the genes we pass on to our children was really, it's very recent, this current wave. It was just kicked off less than a year ago, really, when developments in gene editing kind of hit the news, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that history in a minute. But I wanted to start out by saying that while gene editing can be used on all life forms, from microbes, plants, animals, and even to alter entire ecosystems, there are many applications. What we're going to talk about tonight is the human applications. And in fact, we're going to make a further distinction, and it's a really important one, between human gene editing that would be targeted at helping patients, helping people who are sick, and as a kind of therapy, and actually older methods of genetic modification had been tried in what was called gene therapy in the past, largely unsuccessfully. But using these new kinds of gene editing techniques, gene therapy might turn out to actually live up to that name, gene therapy. And I think there's a very clear and important distinction between gene editing for existing people and gene editing for people who don't exist. They're future people. It would be not to cure or treat anybody, but to create, essentially, genetically modified humans. And that's what I'm going to be talking about tonight. Now, I have a feeling that, from what Greg told me about who's here, that many of you are studying gene editing as actually work that you're going to be doing in laboratories. So I wanted to find out, how many people here are students in the sciences? Can I see a show of hand? Ooh, a lot. Great. That's wonderful. And how many people here are students in the social sciences, humanities, non-science areas? Also a lot. That's great. So I think one of the things that we're going to enact tonight is the kind of necessary cross-disciplinary conversation that is really required at this point for a question of what is really this magnitude. And can I see a show of hands, just curiosity, of how many people here are not students, faculty, staff, community members? Wonderful. Okay. Well, thank you all for coming. So let's see. I thought I would tell you just a little bit about our center, the Center for Genetics and Society. Our mission statement, it reads in part that we work for responsible uses and effective social governance of human genetic and assisted reproductive technologies. And we bring to our assessment of these technologies and practices the values that you see listed there. We really try to center social justice, human rights, and the public interest as we think about what are the appropriate and inappropriate uses of these technologies. We have a lot of resources and information on our website, and I invite you all to take a look at it. There are reports, there are videos, there are lots and lots of articles, 9,000 pages worth at this point. And we actually take within our range a fairly wide number of topics, practices, technologies, all those ones that you see there. But much of our current work, actually now, for the past number of months, has been focusing on the question of editing human genes, the ones we pass on to our children. And that's actually why the Center for Genetics and Society was founded some 15 years ago now, with that as its focus. A word about terminology that, as Greg already mentioned, this prospect of altering the genes that are passed down through the generations goes by a number of different terms. Inheritable human genetic modification, designer babies the media uses, I never heard Roundup Ready Children before. Another term that you'll come across are various ways of using the term germline, and you know, germline sounds like something you should attack with Listerine or Ajax, but germ cells, as many of you know, are the gametes that carry down the DNA that makes us who we are. So we talk about human germline modification or germline gene editing. So let me tell you what I'm going to do in this talk. I'm actually going to try to give you some recent historical context for the controversy that's raging now about human germline modification. So I'll talk about two waves of controversy about this topic that have already taken place in this very still young 21st century. And then I want to talk a little bit about, I want to tell you a little bit about the way the argument is unfolding, the pros and the cons. And my feeling is that this is a line we should draw to be clear right up front, along with many other people in many other countries, as you'll hear. I think that modifying the human germline should be a no-go zone. But I will lay out the arguments. I probably will focus more on the point of view that I hold, but I'll try to represent the way the argument goes. And say a few words about how the argument is unfolding. How do we talk when we talk about human germline modification? So that's what's in store for tonight. So I want to start out with some words about this, what I'm calling the first wave of controversy about inheritable human genetic modification that started out in the late years of the last millennium, the late 1990s, and went through the first few years of the 21st century. And one of the landmarks in that controversy was something that will be familiar, I think, to a lot of you, this film, Gattaca. So one more show of hands. How many people have seen this film? Yeah, it's so interesting. It's still a real landmark. So the not-too-distant future is one of the taglines of this film. And just for those who haven't seen it, You may know about it anyway, but the basic plot is this is a society in which society has split between the genetic haves and have-nots. They're called the valids and the invalids. And the hero, played by Ethan Hawke, is an invalid. He is not genetically enhanced, but he gets to be a rocket scientist anyway. And he gets the girl anyway, Uma Thurman. So this is an interesting message. The message is that, in fact, genes are not destiny. But even though that's the case, we could still see consequences that flow out of the widespread genetic modification of future children that could be really devastating to our striving toward a more equal and fair society. So I think that's actually sometimes lost in the way that people think about Gattaca. We just see it as the tale of, you know, the genetic castes. But the message is actually a little more complicated and nuanced than that, and one that I think we should keep in mind. So Gattaca came out in 1997, and that was the same year of a very interesting announcement, and that was the announcement of the birth of the cloned sheep, Dolly. That was in early 1997. And very quickly after, this was a surprise to biologists that the cloning of mammals was not thought to be possible, but Scottish scientists working at a Scottish veterinary center did it. And very quickly, the conversation turned to human reproductive cloning. And the debate that unfolded about human reproductive cloning was, in a way, kind of a dry run for the conversations about inheritable genetic modification, both the ones that happened in this period and the ones that are happening now. So initially, there was, you know, some support for the idea that we should create human clones. And there were some people who defended this as a matter of what they called procreative liberty, like who should stop us? We should have, you know, complete free choice about the way we reproduce. And then there were some utilitarian arguments about, and some of these are really grisly, about using, we would clone humans, but we would not let the brains develop and use them for spare parts, something like that. There were actually some proposals like that. What happened was, after a short time, a couple years, where these sorts of proposals were actually being seriously put forward, the safety aspects of human cloning became obviously such that no one would try it. When scientists tried to clone animals, it turned out there were very significant species differences between animals. And this, in almost all animals, in all animals really, the success rates were so low. There were hundreds of false tries for every birth of a cloned animal, and some of the animals that were born had real problems, and some of the females, the surrogates that carried those cloned animals also had problems. So the safety concerns kind of, in a way, trumped. Should I use that word anymore? the sort of social and ethical conversation kind of faded and didn't really get to be grappled with completely because the safety concerns were so obvious and we just couldn't go forward with that conversation. So let's see. That conversation kind of fell by the wayside, but meanwhile, the idea of inheritable genetic modification was also being talked about. And these are media portrayals of this idea from the late 1990s. Let's see, this New Scientist one that you see on the left there is late 1998, and the Newsweek is also 1998 on the right there. And you see kind of different ways of talking about this idea. So New Scientist, evolution is dead. The germline gene therapy debate. As I'll explain later, I think the whole idea of germline gene therapy is an oxymoron. But there was this language about how humans are going to assert their mastery over human evolution. And seizing control of evolution was one of the calls in this way of thinking about inheritable human genetic modification. There was also this other kind of approach to it, the designer baby approach. And I don't know if you can read that there. Scientists say that with gene therapy, they may soon be able to cure a child's inherited disease before he is even born, should they be allowed to create kids with made-to-order traits. So that really is not language of seizing control of evolution. It's language about families predetermining traits, families engineering the traits of their children. And you see this, sweet, white baby. Maybe this is the kind of baby that every parent is supposed to want. That's not really discussed. So this was these are a couple examples out of many that we could put up. Here's one more. This was Time magazine. And again, parents can already select their future child's sex and screen for some genetic diseases too. Will they someday select for brains and beauty as well? And so this idea of not just procreative liberty, but procreative liberty in a free market, in a commercial setting. In this same issue of Time, a molecular biologist from Princeton University named Lee Silver was asked to contribute. And I don't know if it was his idea or the editors at Time's idea, but what he contributed was hypothetical ad language for a fertility clinic of the future. And the ad copy called the services provided by this hypothetical fertility clinic organic enhancement. And it said the DNA molecules added to embryos are all natural. And it went on, keep in mind, you must act before you get pregnant. Don't be sorry after she's born. This really is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for your child to be. So that's the kind of appeal that we were seeing here in the late 90s. And this biologist, Lee Silver, actually had written a book. This came out in 1997, right after the announcement of Dolly the Sheep, Remaking Eden, How Genetic Engineering and Cloning Will Transform the American Family. And this was a kind of, Gattaca in a popular trade book. And Silver liked to spin these scenarios of what the world was going to look like after a couple hundred years of using cloning and genetic engineering on human beings. And what he said was that we would see society divide, like in the movie Gattaca. His terminology was the gen-rich and the naturals. And he predicted, not using a cautionary tone, using a very kind of enthused tone, that the gen-rich, who would be 10% of the population, that's the genetically enriched, of course, they would run academia, they would run government, they would run industry, they would excel in sports, they would run the show. And the others, the other 90%, the naturals, they would sweep the floors. And I am paraphrasing only a little bit here. In fact, he said, as wealthy people purchase these upgrades for their offspring and monopolize the gen-rich sector of society, and the naturals, the other 90%, fell behind further and further. He said after another few hundred years, eventually the gen-rich class and the natural class will become entirely separate species with no ability to crossbreed. So that was the kind of language we were seeing in the late 1990s. And this book is actually why I'm standing here today. There's a kind of a direct line between this book and the foundation of the Center for Genetics and Society, and my the reason I expend so much stomach lining on this topic. When I first read this book, I was actually teaching classes at Sonoma State University, and they were classes about science and politics. And I came across this book, and I thought it was fascinating. And I read this stuff, and my jaw dropped to the floor. And I thought, oh well, here's this guy at Princeton. He goes home at night from his mouse lab. He sits down at the computer, and he indulges in mad scientist mode. So although I was appalled, I kind of for a few months somehow managed to just, I put it out of my mind a bit. But it was like, wait a second. I see that there's this book. He's from Princeton. I mean, maybe the ideas are fringe, but Princeton is not fringe, right? So who is he? And I started looking into it, and I found was that it wasn't just Lee Silver, that there were a lot of other scientists as well, and a bunch of futurists and bioethicists, and they were actually kind of mounting what I think you'd have to call a campaign. And they, in fact, to go to the next slide here, they had put on a conference at UCLA in March of 1998 titled Engineering the Human Germline. And it was attended by 1,000 people. It was reported on the front page of the New York Times and the front page of the Washington Post. And the organizers were quite clear that their goal was to make inheritable genetic modification acceptable to the American public. And the conclusion that they drew was not, the question is not if we will alter the genes we pass on to our children, but when and how we will do that. So finding that out, you know, I thought, okay, there's this group of scientists, but there must also be other scientists contesting them. And I was stunned to find out that there really weren't. And I think it was because there were some very prominent scientists involved here, Nobel Prize winners, people who controlled funding, Jim Watson, and other people, maybe not quite that famous, but prominent scientists. And it's very hard to buck that. And so there was silence, almost complete silence from the scientific community. There was... I'll come to that later. There was a little bit of pushback from some also prominent scientists, and some of whom are still involved in the debate, but not much. And there was more language like this coming from people that I think should know better. So Daniel Koshland, who is the editor of Science magazine, I think from about the mid-'80s to the mid-'90s, and has a hall named after him on the UC Berkeley campus. That's what you see there. He said at an event at UC Berkeley in 1999 that we must use human germline modification for this reason. We have created a society that is so technologically complex that we must now create people who are smart enough to manage it. So he also thought that one of the wonderful things about human genetic engineering was that it was going to help us with our homelessness problem. I could not understand that, and never have. But he had high hopes. And then Jim Watson, who is known for saying intemperate things, and finally got in trouble with it not too long ago, and had to step down from some of his positions, like the one at Cold Spring Harbor. But he said all these things, like the ones you see here. If you could find the gene which determines sexuality, and a woman decides she doesn't want a homosexual child, well, let her. In other words, let her terminate that pregnancy. People say it would be terrible if we made all girls pretty. I think it would be great. So, hey, you know, I didn't ever realize it before, but this, you know, this is the Donald Trump of the science world. So aren't you glad you didn't stay home to watch the debate? You got a flavor of it here. So, I mean, Jim Watson was saying things that were really openly, I think you would have to call these eugenicist statements, and these are not the only ones. So in the light of all this, the fact that there weren't other people speaking out, it was troubling, but there was some pushback. So this is to show that in popular culture, we did start to see some pushback. We're not your real parents. Actually, you're a genetically modified tomato. This was from the early 2000s from the British magazine Private Eye. And also there were much more serious, well, let me say a word about the popular culture stuff. I mean, we started to see this topic being treated not just in cartoons and not just in movies and in science fiction, importantly, but not even just in science fiction, also in serious literature. Margaret Atwood's trilogy that begins with the book Oryx and Crake. Does anyone know that? Yeah, she treats this, and Kazuo Ishiguro wrote about cloning in the novel Never Let Me Go, which was made into a film. There are other examples as well. Let's see. So that's popular culture, and also in policy. That's what this slide is about. In many countries, there were conversations, there were policy deliberations about these new biotechnologies during the 1990s and early 2000s. And at that time, every country that actually established public policy passed a law prohibited human germline modification. And that came up to dozens of countries, somewhere around 40 countries, depending on what you count as a law, have laws on the books saying no human germline modification will be permitted. And this treaty, the Convention on Biomedicine and Human Rights, is a Council of Europe treaty. It's a binding international agreement that was first published in 1997. It was open for signature, and it came into force on December 1st, 1999. It's been ratified and signed by 29 nations. So this is the law of the land in most of Europe, in other countries in the world, almost every country with an advanced biotechnological sector, except the United States and China, have laws on the books saying that human germline modification will not be done. There were also some prominent people, including scientists, who spoke out, and I think bravely, because they were going against these prominent advocates. Eric Lander, who's still very much involved in the debate, wrote a commentary for the New York Times, and he said that he thought, you know, even though some of his colleagues were advocating this, he had to part company with them. He said, "I find it unsettling that we've only just skimmed the 3-billion-year-old genetic text, and already they're saying, hey, I think we can improve on this." He said, "If we cross that fateful threshold, I don't see how we can ever return. I part company from some of my colleagues here. While I'm strongly opposed to laws limiting scientific investigation, I would support a ban on modifying the human germline." So he's an important voice. He remains an important voice. We also, at that time, looked around to see who in the public interest world was working on this issue. And then as now, there are very few organizations that are really focusing on it. And I think and I hope that that will change, because as this controversy builds, it is really clear that, and it's really recognized, that this is a conversation that needs to go beyond scientific experts. It needs to go beyond academics. It needs to really get out into civil society, into all the sectors of people who are focused on social issues, including environmentalists, including disability rights and justice folks, reproductive health rights and justice folks, racial justice, people of faith, artists. We all need to be part of this conversation. And while these are small organizations that are focused on this issue, we're seeing more public interest organizations start to get interested. So in the environmental world, Friends of the Earth, we've partnered with them on a report about human genetic engineering, the ACLU, some of the reproductive justice groups. So we are starting to see it, and we're just starting to see it back during this first wave. Okay, so let's move on to the second wave. And this is the one that started just about a year ago. Let's do a little time check. Ooh, I'm going to have to move quickly through this. Okay, well, I think probably this period is more familiar to a lot of you because this is the one that you've been paying attention to. I won't go into a big definition of gene editing. The most famous gene editing tool, CRISPR. Here's a little cartoon explanation of it. Basically, the system consists of a targeting mechanism that finds the right place in the genome, and then a scissors cutting mechanism, a sort of molecular scissors, it's been called, to cut the double strand of the DNA, delete some DNA sequence, replace it with another. The term gene editing, I think, does some important work in sort of suggesting a little bit about how this technique works. But I think it's also misleading in that if you're editing, it's to make us think about word processing, right? But if you're if you're using a word processing software platform on your document, you make a change in one place, you wouldn't expect to see that change show up somewhere else, you know, pages later in the document next month. And the biological equivalent of that can happen with these gene editing tools, at least at this point. Here are some of the developers. These people are Jennifer Doudna, Emmanuel Charpentier, and Feng Zheng. They are named often as possible Nobel Prize recipients for their work developing CRISPR. They're also in a huge patent fight with each other, as you probably know. This issue kind of broke open in the spring last year. This was in March, so just 12 months ago. This was an article in MIT Technology Review that first reported in a relatively popular journal that about the rumors that scientists in various labs were going to use gene editing on human embryos and what that signified for the possibility of creating genetically modified human beings. This prompted many articles to be written, and here are just a few of the first ones. This was in Nature. This article was authored by biotech industry executives. It was titled, "Don't Edit the Human Germline," and the authors pointed out that there are serious risks and the therapeutic benefits are tenuous and that it would be a path towards genetic enhancement. They were pretty unequivocal about their position, and it was quite interesting that this was people from the biotech industry who want to develop gene editing as gene therapy and don't want a lot of political controversy they don't want backlash that would impede those developments and turn people against them. And I think they're quite sincere in what they're saying here as well. A different point of view was put out in Science Magazine, and this was the more research scientist crowd, David Baltimore, Paul Berg, people who've been involved in this field for decades. This group was brought together by Jennifer Doudna, and in Science they published an article titled "A Prudent Path Forward for Genomic Engineering and Germline Gene Modification." These developments were reported on in the New York Times. That's there. And shortly after these articles came out, scientists from Sun Yat-sen University reported in a relatively obscure journal, actually, because Nature and Science didn't want to publish it, about their experiment editing human embryos using CRISPR. They used embryos from a fertility clinic that were not viable, that could never develop into a human being. And that was part of how they saw themselves as doing this in an ethical way. And the experiment was really an interesting experiment in that it failed. They had a lot of what they called off-target mutations. They had mosaicism, meaning that different cells in the embryo, the editing worked differently. So, but it was the first time that this had been done to anyone's knowledge, and it was a big deal. That's why it's front page of the New York Times. And then you got reactions from all these agencies of the United States, the National Institutes of Health, the Office of Science and Technology Policy in the White House, issuing statements saying, we're not going to do this, giving various reasons for it. And the National Academies of Sciences said, okay, we're going to take this on, and we're going to put together this summit, they called it. And that was what happened last December, the International Summit on Human Gene Editing. And they invited as hosting organizations, the Royal Society of the UK and the Chinese Academy of Sciences. They're trying to make it international, as the title says, but tellingly, I think, they did not invite any science academies in any European countries or from the Council of Europe where there is an established policy regime prohibiting germline modification. Well, what happened at this meeting? 500 or so people came to it. I was very, pleased to be invited to speak there, but I was not so happy that the Center for Genetics and Society was the only public interest organization that was represented there on the podium. And so we didn't hear from any of the civil society constituencies that I mentioned. the people who are focusing on social justice, people who are focusing on inequality, on disability rights, on racial justice, on civil liberties. None of those voices were present. And the summit was not designed to produce a consensus among the participants, but at the end, the committee that organized the summit did issue a statement that got a lot of attention and coverage, even though the concluding statement was actually quite inconclusive. Not surprising, I suppose. The statement says that germline gene editing for reproduction has not been shown to be safe or effective. That's kind of the mainstream view, that, you know, it's not safe right now. And so it would be irresponsible to proceed for that reason. But the statement did leave the door open to reconsider that down the road. It said, as scientific knowledge advances and societal views evolve, the clinical use of germline editing should be revisited on a regular basis. So in other words, they kicked the can down the road. They also did say something very important, which was that it would be irresponsible to proceed unless and until a broad societal consensus about the appropriateness of the proposed application could be reached. A broad societal consensus. Now, that's unusual language for a body like this. And what does it mean? You know, no one has any idea what it means. So I think what we do know what it doesn't mean. It doesn't mean that, you know, elite scientists or elite policymakers, for that matter, meeting in small groups should make this decision. That it's a decision that really requires thoughtful, extended in time, meaningfully inclusive, broadly inclusive conversation and set of deliberations about how these technologies should be used, whether they should be used at all for future generations. And I think it is going to be up to people like all of us in this room to make sure that that's what happened. So I want to leave time for questions, but what I think I want to do is just give you in the nutshell the way that we at the Center for Genetics and Society, and again, we're echoing what we hear from around the world and our colleagues, we do work with a pretty wide network at this point of scholars in a range of disciplines and civil society advocates from a range of constituencies. So the argument that we think makes sense against human germline modification is, first of all, it's not safe right now. It may never be safe, but not safe right now, that's totally mainstream. The second piece is it's not really medically necessary. It's often argued that this is a way to prevent the transmission of genetic diseases to the next generation, but here's a really important point. It's not needed for that in almost every case. We have technologies already, embryo screening technologies, that themselves raise some ethical questions, certainly, but that are far safer for the resulting child and far less, put society at far less risk than would germline genetic modification. So there will be a handful of people who cannot produce unaffected embryos, but we're really talking about a handful, tiny number. And everyone who's at risk of passing on a genetic disease can have a healthy, unaffected child if they are willing to use somebody else's eggs or sperm. So the whole argument for it depends on the fact that the desire of parents, not just for an unaffected child, but for a child genetically related to both members of the couple, is more important than any of these risks, even more important than the risks that they would be putting their child to, which it's hard for me to understand, but that's the way the argument goes. The other piece of the argument that's important is that, you know, if you could imagine that maybe that there would be some kind of policy regime where the use of germline genetic modification could be limited just to those handful of people who had no other way to have an unaffected and genetically related child. But you'd have to have a pretty good imagination to imagine that, because in the real world, once you open the door to one kind of germline modification, I think you'd be opening it to all kinds. This is, you know, the FDA can't even regulate off-label uses of drugs. And this would be what that would be. It would be like an off-label use of germline genetic modification, not to prevent the transmission of Tay-Sachs or Huntington's disease, but, you know, to start out, it would be the things that scientists are talking about now, fast twitch muscles so you can be a better sprinter, stronger bones, so you could be a better weightlifter, need less sleep. There's a gene that's very strongly correlated with needing a lot less sleep. And so you would be starting to get these enhancements for parents who could afford them. You would be starting to get these fertility clinics with ad copy like the one that Lee Silver imagined in 1999. You would get competition within societies. You would get competition between societies. These commercial dynamics, I think, would be very powerful. And I think it would be all too likely that we would find ourselves in a world in which we were exacerbating existing kinds of discrimination and inequality and putting entirely new kinds of discrimination and inequality into the world. I think we already have enough of that. We don't need more. So I think we should keep human germline modification as a no-go zone. So I'll stop there and hope that we can talk about this and talk about some of the maybe social issues, ethical issues, safety issues, anything that you would like to comment on or ask about.
So I have a couple of questions. The first is, I'm only 19. Do you think that the Global Summit advocated that we maybe revisit this over time? Do you think this will become an issue that I'm going to have to worry about later on down the road? Or is this going to take a much longer time to develop? What's the timeline that you realistically can see with this?
That's a really interesting question. I think we have a very critical window right now over the next couple of years. The National Academies, in addition to putting on this summit, has also struck another committee that's writing what they call a consensus report. And we don't know, though they're having a series of meetings, hearing from panels of different kinds, and they'll issue a report toward the end of this year, this is their anticipation. So this is a really critical year, but there are also starting to be conversations in other parts of the world. I have a feeling it is going to not be settled finally, no matter what happens, and it is going to keep going on. I mean, you know, it's in the past, even as recently as 15 years ago when I got involved in this, it was hypothetical. I mean, some people thought it was way far out in the future. But now we're at a point where, you know, we can do it, and this gene editing technology is really exciting. It's thrilling. It's so powerful. Scientists are so excited, and you know, for some really good reasons about what they can do and some wonderful things that they can do. But there's also the fact that you can really think about practically trying to create genetically modified people means that I think we have to really have very clear public policy. And even then, I think it's something that's going to be with us for your adult life.
Well, thank you so much for the talk today. Very interesting. So I want to just kind of switch the focus for a little minute. Let's put aside feasibility, practicability, and convenience. And the question that I pose is, are we empowered to be sharp as a laser? Basically, the point is, most of the most important human genetic problems are polygenetics, not monogenetics, which leads the question of, we really don't know what to target. Genome-wide association studies, as an example, they point that the potential positions for being important factors in risk are intergenics, which puts us in a mirror of our ignorance in terms of what will we modify. So it's not only a question of if it's feasible to modify germline. It's, I don't know what's our current knowledge or our current status in the knowledge to be sharp as a laser and be actually knowledgeful of what we are modifying.
That's a very, very important point. I think that's a comment and a question there. And yes, it's true. I mean, the kinds of traits that Lee Silver was talking about for the gen rich, intelligence is the one that everybody wants, right? Cognitive enhancements. Well, you know, we don't have intelligence genes, and there probably will never be intelligence genes, I believe, from what I know about genetics. But it's not stopped scientists from going on hunts for the genius gene. That's what they call it. There's a Beijing Genomics Institute, you know that organization, now called BGI in China. They've got a big project. a project. I don't know how big it is, but it's a reasonably significant project where they're collecting sequences of children who are prodigies, and they're trying to find these genius genes. So that's one kind of answer, that I think that there will be some correlations found with traits that really do matter. We have already, even with old methods of germline modification, genetic engineering methods, we have transgenic animals in laboratories around the world and in farmyards. And, you know, the CRISPR has already been used to create extra-muscled beagles, and old forms of genetic engineering have been used to create mice that could run the maze faster than their unmodified counterparts. So I think there will be some traits that can be controlled. Some scientists are coming up with these ideas for, like, you know, the gene that lets you sleep less. That would be huge if you could, you know, have. I mean, what would you do if you were a parent thinking about having a kid? Would you want to take a chance and try to have a kid who only needed 3 or 4 hours of sleep a night? Think about how much further ahead they could get. I'm serious. It would be a temptation. So that's one kind of answer. And the other kind of answer goes back to what I said about the plot of Gattaca at the beginning. It's you don't actually even need genetically modified children to actually be superior. If they're thought to be superior, I think that in itself could have some pretty nasty consequences. So that's the way that I think about it, but I think it really is important to always remind ourselves and each other that we don't want to fall into a sort of simplistic genetic determinism, and we don't think that our destiny is in our genes, as James Watson said, and we do need to pay attention to the social determinants of health, the environmental determinants of health and well-being. Those things are all really, really important.
You said that you're against it right now for the gene editing, but would you also argue that it could be too early in the research to be fully against it, because in future research it could be proven, like, the implications, what, if they're positive or negative? Do you think that it is, at the time being, too early to say I'm against it or I'm not against it?
Well, I think it's early to say for sure about the safety arguments. I think we don't know yet. It's very early. And I don't know. Will it be safe? I don't know if it'll be safe for gene therapy either. I hope it will be safe for gene therapy. I know we have to be careful, because when we got ahead of ourselves with the old kind of genetic engineering, there were some tragic consequences. There were deaths in clinical trials. So maybe it'll get worked out and if it's worked out, if the safety issues are worked out for gene therapy, in a way it would be easier to edit an embryo or a gamete, you're only talking about, you know, one or a couple of cells there, rather than have to target multiple, you know, millions of cells to, like, you know, have someone with cystic fibrosis get the enzyme they needed to clear the mucus from their lungs. So from a safety point of view, yes, it's early. We know it's premature now to say that we should go ahead and try it. That would be irresponsible, as the National Academy statement said. But that's all about safety. And what I'm trying to bring into the conversation is the social consequences, which are harder and different to think about. You know, we can't quantify those social risks the way we can quantify the number of off-target mutations in a cell, a gene-edited cell. But I think we have to really look at history, look at ethical systems, look at our values as a society, look at what we know about social, commercial, political, cultural dynamics, and really think about whether we want to take the risks that I think it would entail. So even if the safety turns out to be, even if we get past some safety bar, and there'll be lots of arguments about what does it mean to be safe or safe enough, but even if we get past that, I would still be opposed to it in any foreseeable scenario that I can imagine, although, you know, I've tried. I mean, who knows? You know, what if climate change gets really dire and we have to genetically modify people to be able to withstand higher temperatures and to save the species? But we're not there yet, and that's not the way it would be used now. So,
thank you so much for your interesting talk. This is something I've been interested in for the last 10 years. They showed us this in school in a science class when I was like 15. And I've been coming back to think about it. I've been thinking about the movie that we talked about. It really concerns me that the U.S. and China is two major countries who doesn't have a law against this yet. How do you see, how does the future look like in this debate? Is that going to happen? And it seems like it's some kind of Cold War scenario here that who's going to do it first, you know, put down the guns? Or do you think that the U.S. is keeping this door open for a national advantage further on?
Well, we are starting to hear that kind of, really, it's nationalistic rhetoric. But, you know, the country that's the most enthusiastic about this is the U.K. And honestly, I don't know what they put in the water there. But there are some very enthusiastic funders with lots and lots of money and some very enthusiastic researchers who are pushing very hard to move forward on human germline modification. There's more caution in China and the U.S., and in the U.S., there are certain agency-level regulations that make it, right now, the NIH will not fund any kind of research like this, not for entirely good reasons from my point of view. There have been these amendments that have been put into budget bills, into the trillion-dollar budget bills that pass every year. There are these riders that get written in. One writer that's been written in for many years is there will be no embryo-destructive research at all. And that's from the point of view of people who whose beliefs in the status, moral status of embryos is such that they think any research on embryos is should not be done. So, and then this past year, a rider was put in the federal spending bill that actually even prevents the FDA from considering any proposals, and I think that's actually not, first of all, it's a terrible way to make policy. It's a very non-transparent, undemocratic way to make policy. And secondly, I happen to disagree very strongly with the motivation behind that. But it, you know, there are some people at NIH and FDA who clearly they don't want to entertain proposals to modify the human germline, and they have this policy in this weird backdoor way that lets them say we can't do it. So that's the U.S. situation. In China, there are also regulatory-level policies that the status of which are unclear. So they're like central government guidelines that say no germline modification. But the Chinese scientists are saying, we don't really know what those guidelines mean. It's like a lot of other guidelines in China. You're not sure until you violate it whether anyone's going to enforce it or not. So it's a sticky situation, you know, in China and the U.S. And it's very different, as I said, from all these, 40-some countries that have clear laws, binding international treaties. And we're going to have to figure out the politics of this. It's going to be hard because, the U.S. Congress is pretty dysfunctional for all kinds of policies. And this one is a tricky one. So it's not an easy task. It's a challenge.
Something I was wondering is technology has kind of science and technology has a tendency to kind of boom at different points in time, and sometimes that creates really, really fast progress in certain fields. If gene therapy were to get this type of boom and we were to really start to understand gene therapy and how to modify traits for existing humans, wouldn't that cause the same issues as genetically modifying children, as being able to change traits such as intelligence or strength, if we get that far, considering how fast it could develop?
We could enhance adults. Can you raise your hand? Because I can't see who's asking that question. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm looking back there. Okay. Thank you. Yeah, no, again, I think, how do we feel about taking the drugs that let you stay up all night to study and make you sharper? How do we feel about cosmetic surgery to make everybody look the same? These are all, I think, real issues and that raise some of the same social questions and value questions that germline genetic modification raises. I think we have to address them, But I think that the existence, the fact that, some people make this argument, like, we'll give our kids eyeglasses, so why shouldn't we genetically modify them? You know, it's like, I think we have to draw lines somewhere. And so while I think, I don't like it when, all the women my age feel they have to get Botox so they don't, get lines on your face. I don't like that, but, I don't want to prohibit everything, I just think we just need to draw a clear policy line where we can in this place, which doesn't mean that everything else is ethically okay, but it does mean that here we can say as a society, we're going to put this off limits so that we don't get ourselves into Gattaca world.
Didn't the UK just greenlight gene editing last month? And can you comment on the scope of what the extent to which they're allowed to do that, what the regulations were that they put in place, and what your organization said in response to that?
Sure. Let me see if I can answer that really briefly, because we've expended a lot of words and on that. The UK has done two things. One is that they have taken a step toward approving a proposal to use gene editing on viable human embryos in order to study miscarriage. And that's, research on human embryos is something that I would feel a lot better about if we had the clear policy lines that I'm talking about. But, I don't want to stand in the way of research. I think most people who take the positions that I do are not against research. So, and in the UK, in fact, there is a law. That's one of the countries that has a law against human germline modification. The other thing that the UK did last year was that they also greenlighted a germline modification technique that's not gene editing. It has to do with replacing these little organelles that are outside the nucleus. Who's heard of a mitochondria? That's what I'm talking about. So there's these techniques. There's a tiny number of people whose mitochondrial diseases is caused by mutations not in the nucleus but in the mitochondrial DNA. So about 15% of people who have mitochondrial disease have this have the flaw in the mitochondria themselves. Those people, hypothetically, would be candidates for this technique that involves enucleate, taking a nucleus out of an unaffected woman's egg or an embryo made from it, and sticking in the nucleus from the intended parents, so that the children would be genetically related to the intended parents, but the mitochondria would come from a third woman. So these techniques were debated in the UK. They are a form of germline modification. They don't affect the genes that control the traits that we usually think of. The actual mechanical manipulations that take place are actually what they're like cloning. They're nuclear transfer techniques, and the Parliament actually had to vote on this because of the law against human germline modification, and they voted to approve it. So there is this exception in the law now, the first one ever actually in the world to approve a form of germline modification. And it hasn't been done yet. It looks wildly unsafe. But, they say that, and the FDA actually had a two-day meeting about it in February of 2014, and their panel of experts looked at the safety evidence, and they said, we don't see evidence of safety here. But in the UK, they say they're going to go ahead with it. So that's the situation there.
Well, let's all thank Dr. Marcy Donofsky. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.